This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The United Nations warned on Monday that 800,000 people may flee Sudan as rival military factions battled in the capital despite a supposed ceasefire. Reuters' Zachary Goldman tells us more.
Sudan's UN humanitarian coordinator, Abdou Dieng, warned of a, quote, full-blown catastrophe.
As you know, it has been more than 2 weeks of devastating fighting in Sudan, a conflict that is turning Sudan's humanitarian crisis into a full-blown catastrophe.
Hundreds of people have been killed and thousands wounded in battles that erupted between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, in the middle of April. Foreign governments have pulled out their citizens over the past week in a series of operations by air, sea, and land.
That is Reuters' Zachary Goldman reporting. The White House estimates Russian casualties in Ukraine have sharply gone up the past several months. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
Since December,
we estimate that Russia has suffered more than 100,000 casualties, including over 20,000 killed in action.
National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says it's stunning.
It's three times the number of killed in action that the United States faced in the Guadalcanal campaign in World War II, and that was over the course of 5 months as well.
In November, the Pentagon estimated Russia had suffered well over 100,000 killed or wounded in the war's first 8 months. Kirby will not publicly give an estimate for Ukrainian casualties. Sagar Magani, Washington.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has notified Congress that the U.S. could default on its debt as early as June if legislators do not raise or suspend the nation's borrowing authority before then and avert what could potentially become a global financial crisis. This is VOA News. The bodies of several children exhumed in eastern Kenya showed signs of starvation and asphyxiation, according to a government pathologist. Reuters correspondent Rachel Faber tells us more.
Investigators have begun the first autopsies on over 100 people linked to a doomsday cult, whose bodies were discovered last month in shallow graves in the Shakahola Forest. Authorities say the dead were followers of the Good News International Church, led by Pastor Paul McKenzie. He is accused of instructing worshipers to starve themselves to death in order to be the first to go to heaven before the end of the world. McKenzie has been in police custody since April 14th, alongside 14 other suspected cult members.
That is Reuters' Rachel Faber reporting. Seven bodies have been discovered on a rural Oklahoma property where authorities have been searching for two missing teens. AP correspondent Norman Hall.
Investigators say the seven bodies were found near the town of Henrietta, about 90 miles east of Oklahoma City. A spokesman for the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation says the state medical examiner will have to identify the victims, but authorities are no longer searching for the two missing teens or man they may have been with, a registered sex offender. Officials in Okmulgee County have declined to release a location, identities, or causes of death. They will only say that there is no longer a threat to the community. The father of one of the teens says his daughter is among the dead. I'm Norman Hall.
First Republic has become the second large regional bank with assets over $200 billion to fail in just a few weeks. Like Silicon Valley Bank, which was seized by the government on a March 10th, First Republic catered to a wealthy clientele, which helped it grow deposits rapidly, but may have also contributed to its undoing. Investors and analysts have also worried about banks such as Comerica and KeyCorp, which also had large numbers of accounts with deposits above the federally insured level of $250,000. Those banks appear safe for now, according to the analyst. Chinese electric car exporters are starting to compete with global brands in their home markets. They bring fast-developing technology and low prices that Tesla's chief financial officer says are scary. BYD Auto is the biggest-selling Chinese electric brand. It opened a dealership in Japan in February. NIO, a maker of premium-priced SUVs, exports to Europe. The ruling Communist Party has made China the biggest EV market with the help of dollars and subsidies. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Sudan's warring sides agree to negotiate as an already dire humanitarian crisis deepens by the day.
More than 15 million people faced severe food insecurity in Sudan before the conflict began.
Plus, as Russia's war in Ukraine continues to cause death and destruction, the casualties are also adding up for its own forces.
That Russia has suffered more than 100,000 casualties, including over 20,000 killed in action.
And millions take to the streets to mark May Day in a show of discontent over inflation and to demand economic justice. Today is Tuesday, April 2nd, or May 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Lori London in Washington. A glimmer of hope toward ending the conflict in Sudan as warring generals agreed to potential negotiations. A string of temporary truces over the past week has eased fighting in only some parts of Sudan, while fierce battles continue in other areas where civilians have been driven from their homes and the country heads further into disaster. More now from Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma.
The UN's top official in Sudan, Volker Perthes, tells the Associated Press the troubled nation's warring generals have agreed to negotiations, potentially in Saudi Arabia, even as they clash in the capital, despite another three-day extension of a fragile ceasefire. Perthes adds, if the talks come together, they would initially focus on establishing a stable and reliable ceasefire, monitored by national and international observers. But he warns there were still challenges in holding the negotiations. A string of temporary truces over the past week have eased fighting only in some areas, and in others, fierce battles are continuing. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Humanitarian groups are trying to restore the flow of aid in Sudan, where millions of people were already relying on international assistance. The United Nations World Food Program says it's resuming operations in Sudan after a pause of more than 2 weeks, prompted by the killing of three of its staff members. The UN is also sending in its chief emergency relief coordinator to the East African country. Help can't come soon enough as the humanitarian need grows more and more dire by the day. Michael Atit reports from Port Sudan.
The World Food Program said in a statement Monday that it has lifted its suspension of operations in Sudan as the fighting there threatens millions with hunger. The WFP said distribution of food is expected to commence in the states of Gadarif, Jazira, Kassala, and White Nile in the coming days to provide the life-saving assistance that many so desperately need right now. The agency said, "We will take utmost care to ensure the safety of all our staff and partners as we rush to meet the growing needs of the most vulnerable." The WFP suspended operations when three staff members were killed in the first day of the conflict between Sudan's army and the paramilitary unit, the Rapid Support Forces. The WFP noted that more than 15 million people faced severe food insecurity in Sudan before the conflict began, and said it expects the number to grow significantly as the fighting continues. Meanwhile, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has dispatched UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffiths to Sudan to assess the situation there. Writing on Twitter from Nairobi, Kenya, Monday, Griffiths said, "We need to find ways to get aid into the country and distribute it to those in need, as well as protect civilians, ensure safe passage for people fleeing the hostilities, and facilitate relief operations." Griffiths is expected to arrive on Tuesday. Michael Atit for VOA News, Port Sudan.
For a second time in a week, Russia launched a deadly wave of airstrikes across Ukraine overnight on Monday, lobbing 18 missiles that killed at least two people and injured about 40 others, including several children. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the missiles targeted the southeastern railway hub of Pavlograd outside of Kyiv. Air raid sirens blared across the capital around 3:45 a.m. Monday, followed by explosions, as 15 of the missiles were intercepted by Ukrainian defense systems. Kyiv's spring counteroffensive is set to be a decisive point in how Russia's war on Ukraine will end. Progress hugely depends on military supplies from the West. U.S. President Joe Biden has continued to pledge U.S. support. At a news conference while visiting Jerusalem, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy rejected a Russian reporter's statement that McCarthy doesn't support U.S. aid for Ukraine.
I vote for aid for Ukraine. I support aid for Ukraine. I do not support what your country has done you to Ukraine. I do not support your killing of the children either. And I think for one standpoint, you should pull out. And I don't think it's right. And we will continue to support because the rest of the world sees it just as it is.
Meanwhile, the human cost of the war continues to add up on both sides. The White House now estimating that Russian casualties in Ukraine have risen sharply in the past several months. We hear more now from Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
Since December,
we estimate that Russia has suffered more than 100,000 casualties, including over 20,000 killed in action.
National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says it's stunning.
It's three times the number of killed in action that the United States faced in the Guadalcanal campaign in World War II, and that was over the course of 5 months as well.
In November, the Pentagon estimated Russia had suffered well over 100,000 killed or wounded in the war's first 8 months. Kirby will not publicly give an estimate for Ukrainian casualties. Sagar Magani, Washington.
United States regulators said Monday that First Republic Bank has been seized and a deal agreed to sell the bank to J.P. Morgan Chase & Company in what is now the third major U.S. institution to fail in 2 months. Under the deal, J.P. Morgan acquired substantially all First Republic assets and agreed to assume responsibility for its deposits, including those above the federal insurance limit of $250,000 per account. Speaking to reporters on Monday, President Joe Biden hailed moves by U.S. regulators to facilitate the sale of First Republic Bank, protect all of its depositors, and ensure that U.S. taxpayers are not affected.
These actions are going to make sure that the banking system is safe and sound, and that includes protecting small businesses across the country.
Biden also repeated his call for stronger regulation and supervision of large and regional banks. Shares of several regional lenders fell on Monday after the collapse of First Republic Bank. To learn more about the newest bank closure may affect the U.S. banking sector and the economy, VOA's Steve Miller spoke with Nicholas Verone, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
I think there are really two ways to look at it. One is that First Republic was identified as a problem bank already on March 10, at the moment when Silicon Valley Bank failed, and even before, actually, Signature Bank failed. So from that perspective, the fact that it gets resolved and with the purchase of most of its business by J.P. Morgan Chase is closure. It's the end of a sequence of turmoil that started on March 10. That's one way to look at it. There is another way to look at it, which is that these banks should not have failed because they are supervised by the Federal Reserve. And it's a pretty basic duty of prudential supervision to avoid the kind of maturity mismatch and asset liability mismanagement that appears to have happened at First Republic, as it did at Silicon Valley Bank, documented now by the report of the Federal Reserve that was published last Friday. So we have seen embarrassing supervisory failure. And if the Fed failed in its supervisory duties with those two banks, maybe it has failed with others as well. It's very difficult to say. So that creates a kind of general sense of uncertainty, which I think pervades the current moment, even if it's not at this point the case that one can identify any other bank as being particularly problematic.
Nicholas, U.S. President Joe Biden, in his remarks on Monday, said that the U.S. government was making sure that the banking system was safe and sound, while at the same time calling for stronger regulation and supervision of both large and regional banks. So, you know, is that what's needed?
So we don't have an alternative supervisory system. We have what we have, and that's centered on the Federal Reserve, and that's the best the U.S. has for supervising banks. So the fact that it failed so blatantly in the case of banks like Silicon Valley Bank is a cause for concern, but not one that calls for an immediate fix. I think trust has been dented, and it will hopefully be repaired, but that will have to take time.
So how are you looking at this? And I guess, is this the end?
First Republic was clearly in trouble already in March. And in a way, the surprising thing is that it has taken so long to resolve that situation. So I take this transaction as the end of a sequence that started on March 10, rather, or March 9, rather than the beginning of a new phase of turmoil. Having said that, I don't think we can be completely certain that there aren't other pieces of the banking or the broader financial system with risks that may materialize at some point. So at this point, it's impossible for me to pin down this or that firm, this or that market segment as being the source of the next problem.
Nicholas Varone is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Nicholas, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're following these other stories from around the world. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with the foreign ministers of Armenia and Azerbaijan in Washington Monday as part of efforts to ease friction between the South Caucasus rivals. Tensions have flared anew after Azerbaijan installed a checkpoint at the start of the only road linking Armenia to the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh territory. The head of one of Israel's largest opposition parties said Monday that after a month of meetings, there have been no progress toward a compromise on a bitterly disputed judicial overhaul package. The proposed changes led to some of the biggest street protests ever seen in Israel. And China is increasingly barring people from leaving the country, including foreign executives, even as authorities say the country is open for business after 3 years of tight COVID restrictions. A Reuters analysis finds an apparent surge of court cases involving such bans as foreign businesses lobbies voice concern about the trend. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The European Space Agency launched its Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, or JUICE, spacecraft from its Guiana Space Center on Friday, April 14th. According to ESA's JUICE website, the spacecraft is slated to make comprehensive examinations of the solar system's largest planet, as well as its three largest ocean moons, Ganymede, Callisto, and Europa. JUICE, which will use gravity assist to propel it through space, is set to orbit the Jupiter system in July 2031. Since the gas giant planet was discovered by legendary astronomer Galileo Galilei in 1610, the spacecraft carries a commemorative plaque to honor his discoveries. As of now, the JUICE mission will end in September 2035, when the spacecraft will be intentionally crashed into Ganymede. But ESA could also elect to extend the mission. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Across the globe, this year's May Day events unleashed pent-up frustration after 3 years of COVID-19 restrictions. People squeezed by inflation and demanding economic justice took to the streets across Asia, Europe, and the Americas Monday, giving voice to an outpouring of worker discontent. Across France, some 800,000 people mobilized against President Emmanuel Macron's recent move to raise the retirement age. While the marchers were largely peaceful, Paris did contend with pockets of violence. I spoke to Paris-based journalist Catherine Field for more. Catherine, there were reports of pretty chaotic scenes on Monday, particularly in Paris. Was a level of protests like this unexpected?
Trades union organizers had called on their members to come out in force, to use the traditional day of marches in support of workers' rights, to show French President Emmanuel Macron that even though the contested pension reform has been passed into law, they still do not accept it. Unions had hoped that at least 1 million people would join in. They fell short of that, but nevertheless, the numbers were large enough to show there's still a large level of opposition to that reform.
Why is this issue such a big deal for the French people?
Initially, opposition to the pension reform was centered around concerns that people were going to have to work longer before being entitled to a full state pension, and that by the time they did retire, their health would be such that they couldn't enjoy a dignified retirement. It was all about being able to retire while still healthy and being able to lead an active life. However, once the government pushed through the contested reform without a vote in Parliament, using a clause in the Constitution which allows it to do so, the debate changed. Suddenly, it turned into a question of democracy, of legitimacy, and the manner in which President Emmanuel Macron governs France.
And why has Macron been so dug in on this, even though it's so unpopular?
President Macron's argument is that as healthcare improves and people are living longer, the percentage of the population claiming pensions is increasing. At the same time, the percentage of the population in work won't be large enough to fund those pensions. And economists forecast that if there is no reform of the pension fund, then the pension budget alone will be in deficit of some $15 billion by 2030. President Emmanuel Macron says he cannot bequeath that deficit onto the next generation.
And where does it leave him politically?
The president is in a very difficult position. He's lost an enormous amount of legitimacy. He's staked a great deal of political capital on pension reform, balancing the pension budget. That has all now disappeared. And there's a sizable population coming out onto the streets protesting. And these protests are turning very violent in some cities. So Emmanuel Macron seems weak. He's already had to delay some of his other key reforms in areas such as immigration policy. He also still has 4 years of his second presidential term to run. He cannot serve a third term. So for all intents and purposes, he is almost a lame duck president, still with 4 years to run.
And that was Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Potential misconduct by the Australian Security Intelligence Organization could stop the extradition to the United States of a former fighter pilot who was accused of training the Chinese military. 54-year-old Daniel Dugan wants a court in Sydney to temporarily suspend the case against him until an investigation by Australia's Inspector General of Intelligence and Security is completed. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has the story.
The United States has accused Daniel Dugan of training Chinese fighter pilots in violation of the Arms Export Control Act. The former Marine airman has been in custody since his arrest last October in the Australian state of New South Wales. His lawyers have argued he's been the victim of a conspiracy by the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation and have claimed it lured Dugan back to Australia from China. He was then detained at the request of the US. Dugan had applied for an Australian government job in aviation that needed security clearance. That was initially granted but was revoked soon after he returned to Australia. His legal team wants the extradition case to be halted while an independent inquiry is carried out by the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security, which reviews the activities of Australia's six intelligence agencies. The former US Marine pilot's lawyer is Dennis Morales. He told reporters outside the court in Sydney Monday that the case was taking its toll on the former US Marine Corps pilot.
Dan is completely emotionally disturbed by the impact this continues to have on his children and his family. This matter, unfortunately, will continue to take some time before it can be resolved. Dan knows that all the steps that have been taken are intended to secure his rights and to protect him and to create the most favourable environment for him to be able to beat the extradition request from the US.
The former Marine airman is an Australian citizen who's renounced his US citizenship. He denies breaking any law and has said he was training Chinese civilian, not military pilots. The Australian government approved a request for his extradition almost 4 months ago. A magistrate in Sydney will decide if Duggan is eligible for extradition to the United States to face criminal charges. The application by his legal team for proceedings to be suspended is scheduled to be heard in July. Lawyers for the US government have said they intend to contest the so-called stay application. Australia, the United States and Britain in recent months have launched a crackdown on former military pilots being recruited by China. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
More details are being revealed about this week's coronation service for King Charles III. It will be one of many faiths and languages, as Charles is keen to show that he can be a unifying figure that represents a contemporary society. He'll be crowned in a ceremony that will be for the first time, including the active participation of faiths other than the Church of England, with Buddhist, Hindu, Jewish, Muslim, and Sikh leaders taking part in various aspects of the coronation. This has been International Edition on Voice of America. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently met in Brussels with several European leaders in meetings that underscored the importance and vigor of the transatlantic alliance. After a meeting with EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy Josep Borrell, Secretary Blinken said their discussion included global challenges where United States and European cooperation can make a difference, from Ethiopia to the Central African Republic to the Middle East. A significant focus of their talk, however, centered around Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine. The United States and the EU countries continue to work in lockstep, together with a broad coalition of partners, to ensure that Ukraine can defend itself, its people, its territory, the right to choose its own path, said Secretary Blinken. He pointed out that European partners have spent about $13 billion in military assistance to Ukraine so far, in addition to billions in economic and humanitarian assistance. Moreover, the EU recently announced it will provide Ukraine with an additional €2 billion in euros worth of ammunition through its European peace facility. The U.S. also announced a new military aid package for Ukraine that includes $500 million in ammunition and equipment and $2.1 billion in ammunition, mortar systems, rockets, and anti-armor systems. The European Union and the United States are also deploying sweeping sanctions and export controls that are degrading Russia's capacity to wage war. He praised the European Union for cutting its dependence on Russian gas from nearly 40% at the start of the war to about 15% at the end of 2022, aided by the 140% increase in U.S. liquefied natural gas exports to Europe last year. Another area of unprecedented cooperation is energy security, which requires a shared commitment to prevent a climate catastrophe. The U.S. and the EU, Secretary Blinken declared, are determined to accelerate the global clean energy transition, building resilient, secure, and diversified supply chains for renewable energy. Secretary Blinken noted that running through all the discussions with High Representative Borrell was a joint focus on revitalizing their democracies and democratic values. values. The relationship between the United States and the European Union is the most comprehensive, dynamic relationship in the world, said Secretary Blinken, and I am pleased to continue our work to deliver a stronger and more secure future for people on both sides of the Atlantic.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.